of Buddhism toward prayer and meditation and contemplation. As a very well-known English Buddhologist, Edward Conze, has said, here I have a Russian translation of his famous popular book, Buddhist Meditation. He says that, like prayer in Christianity, meditation is the very heart of Buddhism and of Buddhist practice. Buddhism isn't very attentive to dogmatics, to some dogmatical definitions, but it is very practical, and it can be said utilitarian and pragmatic religion. And its goal is to transform living beings, human beings, first of all, into exalted and enlightened or awakened beings. Arhat in Theravada or Bodhisattva and Buddha in Mahayana. And first of all, when we speak about tradition of mystical prayer in Buddhism, we must say at first about meditation and contemplation. Yes, of course, Buddhism knows prayer in as such, yes, but it is much less important than different methods of contemplation and meditation. And contemplation meditation is a Buddhist analog of Christian or Islamic or Jewish prayer. And during my lectures, I will speak first of all about this tradition of Buddhist contemplative practice. I must say that contemplation and meditation is the very foundation of Buddhism. And here I must say that the founder of Buddhism, Buddha Shakyamuni, realized his nature, or attained enlightenment or awakening through long and hard practice of meditation. And this experience of Siddhartha Gautama, who became Buddha Shakyamuni, or awakened seer from the clan of Shakya, is a paradigm for every Buddhist. Buddha was the first master, first teacher. If we work like Buddha, if we do what Buddha did, we will attain the same fruit as Buddha attained in his life. Of course, it is very difficult to speak about Buddhism in general. There is no Buddhism as such. There are several, even a lot of different branches or trends of Buddhism, of Theravada Buddhism, of Mahayana Buddhism, in Tibet, in China, Japan, Thailand, etc. But nevertheless, we can find the most important, the most essential features common to all trends and branches of Buddhism, their attitude toward meditation and contemplation. Perhaps it would be better if I say some words about principal doctrinal essentials of Buddhism, the so-called Four Noble Truths. It is very interesting example of Buddhist understanding of doctrine. What are Four Noble Truths? I hope that everybody...
Four Noble Truths.
Four Noble Truths. I hope that everybody knows them, but I will repeat. The fashionable truth is that the very existence in its foundations is but suffering, or it is unsatisfactory, it's better interpretation. It is frustrating. Yes, there is no principally perfect state in this tribal world. The second one, because is that the cause of suffering is desire or lust or passion. If there were no passion or lust, there were no sufferings. The third noble truth is that there exists perfect state which is free from sufferings, and this state is nirvana from Sanskrit root, near to vanish, to stop, to disappear, like waves vanish when there is no wind over the sea, or like fire or the candle vanishes where there is no oil which nourishes it. The sufferings exhaust when there is no passions or lust which nourishes them. And the first noble truth is the truth of the path, or of the way. It is path or way. It is eightfold noble way, which is the practical side of Buddhism. Some words about this eightfold noble path. It may be divided into three main stages. The first stage is a stage of wisdom. The second stage is the stage of moral or practicing some precepts for monks. And the third is the stage of concentration. The first stage includes two steps and other thank you. And other procedures include thank you. Include three steps in each. The first stage, the stage of wisdom. This is correct vision, the first, correct vision or correct understanding. True and firm insight into the sense of the noble truth, and readiness to live according to this understanding, existential understanding of those truths. The second is true attitude. Then it begins the stage of morals or practicing the precepts. It consists of three steps: true behavior, true way of life, and true speech. The very core of these three steps is absolute abundance of any enforcement of any not only killing, but other cruel acts directed on any living creature, or ahimsa, ahimsa in Sanskrit. And
non-violence in English?
Yes, violence. And the third stage of this normal way is true concentration and or samyak samadhi. And this true concentration is but a synonym for Buddhist meditation, for contemplative practice. And it will result in some complete quietude of mind, which must become like very clear, very clear mirror, which reflects all the light and all the phenomena in their true shapes. And then I must say some words about some specific features of Buddhism which are known to most of other religious traditions of the world. I mean the non-theistic nature of Buddhism. Most of religions are polytheistic or monotheistic, pantheistic, and so on. That is, most of the religions concentrate their doctrines and their attitudes, their faith, along the notion of God. Buddhism isn't the religion of this type. The gods of Buddhism, that is Brahma, Indra, or whatever, are not gods in some absolute sense. These gods are living creatures like ourselves. They have many powers. They live in the paradises and heavens, but they are only living creatures, limited with limited span of life. They are subjects of birth and death. The span of life may be very, very prolonged, very long, extremely long, but nevertheless they will die, and according to the law of karma, they will reborn, rebirth again, as creatures of another type, and so far it is not the goal of Buddhism to attain this divine state. Yes, some good deeds may give us karma to be born among the gods, but it is not the goal of Buddhism. Moreover, the position of human being is best than the position of the gods. Gods are too blissful. They do not, they can't understand the essence of existence or suffering. But they also suffer, and they know the death and some illness between death, they, and etc. The situation of a human being is much better than the situation of those devas or semi-gods. Human beings are thinking beings. They have no such bliss, for such wrong bliss of goods, and they have no so much sufferings as the creatures living in the hells. Hell in Buddhism also is a temporary state. For example, if I will do some very bad doings, they will result in my rebirth in the hell. But when the energy of my bad deeds will exhaust, I will be reborn again in another state of being, as animal or as a human being, etc. So the situation of a human being as the middle or central situation is much more preferable than the position of semigods. And to be such a semigod isn't the goal of Buddhism. It is can be said that the gods, semigods themselves must be liberated from the cyclic existence of samsara, from this unending cycle of birth and death. Then, Buddhism isn't a religion of which has a doctrine of divine creation. Samsara, or the world of birth and death, is but a result of a total karma of living beings, of total of energy of their deeds, their will in Schopenhauer sense, I think. And if all the beings are liberated, samsara will be entified and it must be ended. This theistic attitude is very important for understanding of some specific features of Buddhism regarding the practice of meditation and contemplation. I'm sorry?
This
non-theistic attitude. Of course.
You spoke of the semi-gods.
Yeah.
How have they liberated?
They can't liberate themselves by their will. They have no attitude to liberation. They are very ignorant beings. Very ignorant beings in Buddhist sense. They can't understand the nature of existence as suffering. They do not see sufferings. Yes. And only if, as a result of their karma, they are born as human beings, they can obtain the possibility to be liberated from samsara.
Where does the karma come from?
Karma is a very old idea. This idea was rooted in Upanishads, in Brahmanical tradition, but Buddhism and another Indian religion, Jainism, made very much for detailed elevation of this context. The word karma means deed or act. The idea is the following: every act, physical, verbal or mental, has its result, its fruit, power. And the sum total of our acts will be resulted in the next life. Yes.
That
Yes, 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 yes. I was going to speak about Anatmavada doctrine. Yes, it is also a very important specific feature of Buddhism, Anatmavada doctrine or no soul doctrine. Most of the Indian religions, such as Hinduism and Jainism, has an idea of absolute, substantial and simple self, or soul, Atman. But Buddhism believes that the very concept of Atman, or substantial eternal soul, is the root of ignorance and different passions. If I have the idea of self or I can say this is mine and this is not mine, this is I and non-self. I can be, I can desire some things different from myself, and I have strong egoistic feelings which prevents from liberation. And if there is no self, what is a person or Buddha? There is a very interesting Buddhist text, Questions of Melinda, Questions of King Melinda. Melinda was one of Indo-Hellenistic kings. Melinda is Menander, after Alexander the Great, there were some Hellenized Indian states. And he discussed with Buddhist monk Nagasena on different questions. And after those discussions, the king became a Buddhist. And this king, Melinda, asked Nagasena, "You Buddhist deny the idea of substantial self, but what is a person?" Nagasena answers, "O king, look at the window. You see a chariot. What is a chariot? Is it wheel? No. Chariot, yes. Is it another part of this chariot? No. Is it all parts of the chariot together? The chariot? No. But what is a chariot? It is all a name which designates wheels and all other parts of this thing. And person also is only a name which designates the totality of five groups of elements, that is Rupaskanda or matter, it can be said. It is not exact translation, but is rather form, yes. Rupaskandha, then Vedanaskandha, feelings, Samjaskandha, some ability to make differences and to construct ideas. Then Samskaraskandha, it is active or volitional, formative aspect of our experience. And Vijnanaskandha, or consciousness as such. And those skandhas also are not bricks which are the part of the house of our personality. They also are but groups of elements, elementary particles of dharmas. And is it, and those countries have dynamical nature, like continuum, it's like stream of psychophysical experience. And every configuration of each configuration of those elements, of those dharmas, can be seen as definite living being. For example, this life, dharmas of elements, obtained the configuration, a configuration which can be seen as this person, Evgeny Korchinov, and because of my deeds, it will change in future. The configuration of the elements will change. It is perpetually changes in reality, but there will be after my death, there will be radical change in configuration. A new configuration can be seen as the second living creature or being my karmic my karmic heritage and who is the person who obtains heritage?
Successor.
My karmic successor. Or in profile speech, it will be my second boss. Yes, if it is possible, now I will speak about Mahayana. Mahayana and Theravada and the distinction between those traditions will be the topic of my second lecture. Have any questions? Now let us speak about some principal terms which can be used in the Buddhist tradition to designate different types of contemplation and meditational activities. There are a lot of such terms. Yoga, dhyana, bhavana, samatha, vipassana, samapatti, anusmriti, and some others. But the most important from them are yoga, dhyana, and bhavana. And now, yes. And now I will stay on these three concepts, yoga, dhyana, and bhava. Yoga is very important for understanding of Indian spirituality and Indian way of thinking, Indian understanding of religion and religious goals as such. And it can be used in two principal meanings. First is broad one. All practical methods of psychopractices, the goal of which is some highest religious goal, that is liberation. From the Hindu point of view, it may be realization of the same nature of myself, Atman, and Absolute or Brahman, or the implication, union mystica of my soul and the God, Parthi, Buddha, Vishwa. In Sankhya tradition, it may be some distinction, principal distinction between spirit Purusha and matter Prakriti and so on. Yogic methods in this broad sense as psychopractical methods leading to the realization of the highest religious goal are common to all Indian religious traditions. And we can say about Hindu yoga, Buddhist yoga, Jainist yoga, and so on. And in some figurative sense, some persons even speak about Sufism as Muslim yoga, etc. Yoga as a word designating the psychopractical methods of realization of the highest religious goal through different systems of physical exercises. In a strict sense, it is one of the Brahmanical philosophical systems, dharmas, yoga sutra of Patanjali. But now I speak about yoga in more broad sense. In earliest Buddhist texts, there is no such word as yoga. But from the beginning of Christian era, this word becomes one of the most often used in Buddhist texts to designate all practical, contemplative, meditational methods of Buddhism. Not only in Hayana, but in Theravada or Hinayana as well. And as you know, one of the most important philosophical trends of Mahayana Buddhism has the name of Yogacara, that is the school of the practice of yoga. This word yoga is derived from the root yogi. As Indo-European root, it has strong semantic relation to such words as English yoke and Russian. Sense of this yoke is to join something, to unite something, and it is usually supposed in popular literature that the sense is the union of soul and God, but I think that it is true. The yoga darshan of Patanjali, for example, of Brahmanical yoga isn't unionistic. It is only liberation of spirit, purified from matter, but it is not some communion with the Godhead. And in Buddhism, potentially, yes. And in Buddhism, of course, there is no such idea as some mystical union of soul and God, because there is no soul, and perhaps there is no God as creator. I think that this communion is some concentration of all powers of will, of mind, the concentration in one point to attain maximum of mental and psychical strength to realize the goal. Yes, but the Buddhist term is anatmavada. Yes, and that is no Atman theory. And Atman is but stable, unchanging, substantial soul, which is subject and not object. Yes, and if we deny the idea of Atman, we deny the idea of this permanent, stable, simple, substantial subject. Oh yes, of course. Of course, of course. Oh no. I don't think so. I think no. I think that Mahayana made this Anatmavada theory much more stronger. the humanistic idea is a problem eratmia, that is, a person is devoid of stable soul, yes? And the mechanistic idea is not only that Pudgon eratmia, but that is Dharma eratmia. Every element, every dharma, every atomic element of existence, of our experience, is devoid of essence. It's much more stronger. I think that you mean as a live jnana concept, or the soul consciousness concept of the natural being. It isn't soul, it's only stream of basic consciousness. It is momentary, and it is not soul, of course. But now I have no time to speak about it. It is not soul, of course. But the Mahayana, of course, has idea of the Buddha nature, but it's not soul. As the nature of every wave is the nature of water, yes? In every wave and in every drop of water, yes? There is one and the same nature. This is the nature of water. All the phenomena have one and the same nature. This is the nature of Buddha. It is just another concept. The second term is dhyana.
Dhyana.
From, or in Pali, dhyana. From the verb dhyati, to be aware of an object. Yoga, yes, in Buddhist sense, yoga is a general term to designate all the complex, all complex of psycho practices or psychophysical exercises which must lead us to the attainment of the religious goal of Buddha, that is Nirvana, or attainment of the Buddhahood, etc.
I just want to clarify, I'm not speaking so you can hear me, but just so the recording can pick it up. What, in what way is the particular Buddhist sense different from the general Hindu sense?
No. I said that there are two senses of this term. The broad sense and the strict Hindu sense. Yes, in broad sense, yoga is the word which means all psycho practices common to all religions of India, such as Hinduism, Buddhism, and Jainism. And the strict sense is only Brahmanic or Hindu sense. It's darshana or philosophical system of Patanjali. And now I spoke about yoga in the broad sense. And then dhyana, or dhyana in the language of Pali, which is the sacred language of the southern prince of Buddhism. It is a derivative from the verb, root, from verb dhyati, to be aware of an object. This term has many meanings. Sometimes it has a meaning of contemplation as such. Sometimes it can designate samatha when versus vipassana. What is samatha and what is vipassana? Will be very brief. I will speak in more details about some samatha and vipassana on the next lecture. Samatha and vipassana are very ancient form of Buddhist practice. Samatha is tranquilization of consciousness, and vipassana is something like analytical meditation. And when they must be practiced together, but in some cases there is an opposition of samatha, or tranquilization, and vipassana as analytical thinking. And when there is such a position, the word dhyana may designate samatha or tranquilization. But
tranquilization.
To make consciousness peaceful, quiet, tranquil, stable. Sometimes this word, dhyana, can be used to designate some levels of yogic concentration, of yogic concentration. And these levels correspond to different levels of the Buddhist cosmology. For example, samsara, or the world of cyclic existence, consists of three worlds. That is kamadvata, world of desires, it is our world, then upadvata, world of pure forms, and arupadhata, the world of non-forms. All the three worlds is not samsara, it is not the world of non-forms, it is nirvana, it is also included in samsara. Moreover, it must be the world of meditational practice. But our consciousness is explicated on the level of kamadhat, on the world of desires. But I can practice Buddhist, practice Buddhist yoga. I can make this level of explication of my consciousness higher and higher. And it will be explicated on the level of pure forms, non-forms. There are different dhyanas or steps of this explication of consciousness. For example, when Buddha entered the final nirvana, he entered the state of dhyana, contemplation, and passed from the first dhyana to the fourth level of concentration, fourth dhyana, and then to the eighth, the most high level. But then he returned to the fourth dhyana, the fourth level, and from this level entered nirvana. It is not necessary to go to the eighth level. The first level is is enough to enter the final nirvana. And in some contexts, this word yoga, like the word yoga, means contemplative activities as such. For example, the Far Eastern school of Buddhism, which is well known by independent day them, actually is a transcription of the Sanskrit Dhyana, that is the school of Dhyana, contemplators. And the Chinese do not like very long words, and they used only the first part of this China, the Chang. And the Japanese meaning of this character is Zen. The Korean phonem written is Tian.
Zen comes from Tian.
Yeah, Tian. This is a Tian school, or contemplation. And in this case, Tian is but contemplation as such. The school which there are a lot of objects of contemplation. It depends on the type of contemplation. It can be my own stream of psychical life. It can be the idea of universal Buddhahood. There are a lot of types of contemplations in Buddhism and objects of contemplation.
Yes, and now I will talk more about some principle attitude. Yeah. Is a level of concentration of consciousness. When I begin my contemplation, my concentration is rather weak. Yes, it is the first stage. Then it became more and more strong. The second stage is the second Jhana Sutra. And I will tell about it next time. Yes, it's... Yes, of course, of course, of course, of course, yes. Not merely, but concentration of consciousness, I think. Or a cultivation of consciousness. But Buddhism doesn't... Buddhism hasn't idea of technique for technique. Yes, for example, we can be very well trained in contemplation, and we can do our contemplative exercise more and more subtle and complex. And it can, become the practice for practice itself. Yes, it is very bad, very bad. Practice has no volume itself and by itself. It has volume because of its liberation. Attitude or liberational meaning, liberational intention. It is enough to attain the first level of concentration, first jhana to enter nirvana. And so you mustn't practice fifth, sixth, seventh, etc. Yes, yes, yes. Yes, yes, yes. fifth and sixth are levels of concentration, and the Tibetan texts describe these levels. For example, the qualities of the first stage is vitaka. Vitaka, that is some peacefulness of mind. Then vichara, that is analytical thinking. Then it's a piti, that is sukha or bliss, that is a kagrata or one-pointedness of consciousness. And then, this is the fourth jhana. On the fifth stage, there is no vitaka, on the sixth there is no vichara, etc. And on the twelfth level, there is no anything. It is the world of no time, no space, no perception, no non-perception, etc. Important, and it is also common to Buddhism and Brahmanism. Samadhi, technically, is the name of the final or eighth step of the Eightfold Noble Path of Buddhism, Samyak Samadhi. or true concentration. And the meaning of this word samadhi is that concentration of consciousness, concentration of consciousness. Samadhi is, and in some context samadhi is a result more often than process. Samadhi is, yes, a result of some radical practice, one-pointedness of consciousness. And the last term, Bhavana is derived from the root Bhu, which means to cultivate, to develop, to practice. It is general designation of such practices, but if dhyana is an exercise, yes, if dhyana is exercise, bhavana is a psychological productive practice. For example, I can practice some kinds of dhyana. For example, I will concentrate on this land, and I will develop attention and power concentration. But this exercise has no psychological meaning. It doesn't lead myself to liberation. It is dhyana, but it is not power. But if I concentrate my attention on mantra, on mani padme hum, this concentration will have a psychological meaning. Will be a means for my liberation, and then the dhyana will become a bhava. Every practice in the bhavana, every practice in the bhavana, if it is useful for the realization of the goal of Buddhism. It is not a type of practice, but the quality of practice, the quality of usefulness in the realm of the attainment of the goal of Buddhism. Therefore, we can say that dhyana is contemplation, samadhi is concentration, and bhavana is practice. Religiously oriented practice. No, but dhyana is bhavana if it has a legal sense. Every dhyana, yes, is a bhavana if it has a legal sense. Yes, a bhavana is a quality of practice, but not type of practice. Yeah. Perhaps if you have some intention. With charity. The first of Buddhist paramitas or transcendental qualities is the paramita of charity, paramita of dhini, dana paramita. Yes. But real charity, real gift will become bhavana or paramita if you fulfill it with concrete Buddhistic intention. For example, if it is a means to transcend your notion of ego. Yes? Intention is rather important aspect of Buddhist practice. I can do some good acts, also good acts, with evil inclination. And it will have no liberating power. But if my act is good, not outwardly but inwardly, it will have liberating quality. Yes. And some words about such Buddhist practice and mantra, as mantra, which is near to the notion of prayer as such. Types of Buddhist practice is even has also even a name of mantra jhana, that is the vehicle of mantras. Vehicle, the channel. Vehicle of mantras. This jhana is vehicle, or carrier. And Hinayana, Mahayana, small vehicle, great. We can say Buddhist mantras. There are a lot of types of mantras in Buddhism. For example, there are some mantras which express some doctrinal aspects of Buddhism. For example, Om Svabhava Shuddha Sarva Dharma Svabhava Shuddha Om. It's a Mahayanistic mantra. Om, yesterday you have told us about this sacred syllable, but in Buddhism it has no such sacred senses in Hinduism. It's only the syllable which is the untold syllable of the mantra. It is separate as Hebrew and Christian Amen. Amen. Yes, yes. It was the formal beginning of mantra. Who is self-being, all self-nature? Self-nature of all karmas or of all elements is pure. Hum. Om Svabhava Shuddha Sarva Dharma Svabhava Shuddha Hum. Om. Self-nature of all karmas is pure. Pure is self-being of all karmas. Hum. Well, in Buddhism it is some formal designation of the mantra character of the text. Yes, mantric. Yes, what is mantra is doctrinal meaning. Yes, it expresses the principal idea of Mahayana Buddhism, that all karmas have the nature of Buddha, and by their self-nature, Svabhava, they are pure from all defilements. There are some mantras of very complex using. For example, famous Tibetan mantra, in the Tibetan mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. It is mantra of compassionate, all compassion, but the sattva avalokiteshvara, and its verbal meaning is something to be glorified, a lotus yield one. Be glorified. Addressing Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, Buddhist holy being of compassionate nature.
But
I will analyze all this mantra in details when we speak about Tibetan Vajrayana tradition. Yes, the place of mystical prayer in Buddhism is occupied by mystical contemplation or meditation. I don't like the word meditation, I prefer contemplation. Meditation is related to a Roman root of with the meaning of thinking, to meditate, to think. In French, meditation is something like thinking, yes. But some powers will tell meditation, meditational techniques of Buddhism are related to the transcendental of discursive thinking. This thinking must be transcended. And so contemplation is the better word than meditation, yes. But there is something like mystical prayer in the strict sense in Buddhism, and this is the practice of some type of mantras. And now I just am speaking about mantras. Then, there are some very specific mystical mantras or siddha mantras, bija mantras, in tantric forms of Buddhism, especially in Vajrayana of Tibet. Then you have no any literal meaning, and they may be understood as energetically powerful spells, I can say, which can be used for activization of some psychophysical centers of the subtle body. Yes. For example, there are a lot of such mantras, and it is very substantial to know proper pronunciation. This proper pronunciation can be given only, thank you very much, only by personal master, personal teacher. And without proper pronunciation, it can be something like hri or phat or amaho, etc. But they have no literal meaning. And there are some devotional mantras, devotional mantras. The most famous of them is the mantra of Amitabha Buddha, or the Buddha of immeasurable light, unlimited light. Now, I will speak about this Buddha and his cult in details, because we will have a lecture on Pure Land Buddhism, which is the Buddhism of the cult of the Buddha Amitabha. And now only some preliminary words. The formula is Namo Amitabhaya in Sanskrit, or Namo Amitabha in Chinese, or Namo Amitabhutsu in Japanese. This is the practice of repeating of the Buddha's name, and the followers of this trend of Buddhism, Pure Land Buddhism, of Amitaism, believe that the very repetition of the name of this Buddha, Amitabha Buddha, has liberational sense due to the power of the voice of Buddha Amitabha. We can be liberated through faith in
him and his powers, and through the repetition of his name. In the Far East, this practice is known as Kohenjin, or known also in Japan, something like memory of Buddha, or yes, mindfulness of Buddha's name, mindfulness. It is very interesting. Some popularization of this formula because of its popularity. Formula Amitofo, or Nam Amitofo in Chinese, homage to Amitabha Buddha. The Chinese repeat this formula very, very often, or very often, every day, many, many times. And because of this non-correct repetition, without mindfulness, without concentration, it became profanized. Yes, and now sometimes, if we sometimes are very surprised, we can, if we can say, oh, Jesus, yeah? If we aren't Christian, but we can speak of Jesus without thinking about Jesus, yes, or my God, it's all exclamation, yes. And the Chinese in such cases pronounce Amitofo, but the religious sense of such repetition is the faith in the liberation of power of the Buddha name. Yes, yes. And for the second vector, I will be very grateful to you if you read some appears some parts from this video. And this is number fourth, the awakening of faith, the awakening of faith, but not the whole text, but but until this type of studies in East Asian Buddhism until this place. There's no imagination here. Subtitle is, I'm sorry, Studies in East Asian Buddhism 3, the Northern School, yes.
I pour my whole self out in giving alms to the poor. If I pour my whole self, my whole intentionality is to empty into other, so other person, a poor person. If in concentrating, as you said, on that light bulb, I intend to pour my whole self out into that light bulb, why cannot I be liberated in the Buddhist sense?
I must say that Buddhism doesn't negate the personality as such. Buddhism
gates of the whole notion of personality as something permanent, as something unchangeable, as something eternal and simple, which is the root of all, how is to say, of all egocentric attitudes and passions. Yes, and we might exhaust this feeling and this notion of self, but not personality as such. As we know, when Buddha was asked about the status of the personality in Nirvana, Buddha didn't answer this question.
Two points that come to mind that I want to keep in focus for future discussions of the upcoming lectures. What is the relationship between cosmology and prayer, or cosmology and meditation?
Cosmology.
Yeah.
Because
Let me just say something and then
yes.
We heard yesterday.
I must tell some words about the nature of cosmology of Buddhism. Yeah. It's a special theme, I suppose, but I will try to clarify it in.
You want to do this now or in another lecture?
As you want.
What are you planning to do it later?
Perhaps so.
You are planning.
Perhaps so.
Okay, so the point I want to make is simply that Lila spoke yesterday about the Vedas and how she considers the maintenance of the cosmic cycle to be a kind of communal form of mystical prayer.
Especially important in this case is not a cosmic cycle as a temporal cycle, but levels of the triple ones.
Okay, I'm actually not asking a question, I'm making a statement. Okay,
let me try and get
to the end. So, we have there one form of correspondence of the cosmological structure to what we consider to be the intent of mystical prayer. Now, you offered us today a second model. You didn't spell it out yet, but you spoke earlier about the fact that part of Buddha's meditation has this correspondence to the cosmological structure, and you just told us that we'll talk about it another day. I suspect Mayer is going to do something similar when he talks about. So it's very interesting that to think about which traditions postulate a relationship between the structure of cosmology and mystical prayer and which don't. I suspect it's going to be something less central to Christianity, though you may want to come back to it either now or later, and possibly also less to it is important, the cosmological structure. Okay, are you going to have an occasion to tell us about it? Okay, so this is going to come up. So it may be then, so maybe the question ought to be addressed to Harvey, is Christianity the only exception to a system of intent, if we can coin a phrase that captures both prayer and meditation together, a system of intent that sidesteps the cosmological dimension. Is there something you can say about it?
Properly, the relationship between prayer and cosmology. All right. Well,
but if you don't understand the question offhand.
Well, I'm not certain. All right. Well, not really, because I think I can answer what I think the question is. All right. For Christians, for example, praying the Psalms, that all of creation praises God. Right, there's a definite cosmology there. The very first chapter in Genesis, when God creates and says, it's good, that definitely enters into Christian prayer. It has to enter into Christian prayer. That's why Christians would disagree so much with the Manichaeans or any type of dualism, that creation is
is good. There are many mystics in the Christian tradition who would begin with some sort of contemplation of the visible, beautiful world that points to God. Bonaventure is a beautiful ascent of the mind to God. It's clear he begins with the world, the physical world, cosmology, and in that he finds God's indwelling, and then he begins to go inward. But the first two steps, certainly in Bonaventure, is the world. St. John of the Cross.